available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello there, and welcome from me, Ashley Haywood, to this week's Outlook programme, which is being recorded on Wednesday, the 29th of October, 2025. Coming up today, we're going to learn about the village of No Man's Heath, as well as Claybrook Parish Church. We're also going to hear from the writer Anne Cleave, as well as finding out all about olives and the fear of spiders. We've also got the answers to Nigel's quiz, as well as the latest news from the Hub, the Sport and your postbag. But first we have, as ever, the latest local news read today by Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
The current arrangement of local government in Warwickshire is set to change over the next 3 years. At present, there is a two-tier system of government, with Warwickshire County Council and five district councils, which are North Warwickshire, Nuneaton and Bedworth, Rugby, Warwick and Stratford. The County Council runs education, social services, strategic transport planning, road maintenance, libraries and cultural services, public transport, waste disposal, public health, trading standards and emergency planning. District councils are responsible for housing, local planning, waste collection, street cleaning, environmental health, food safety, pollution and pest control, parks and recreation, community centres, elections and council tax billing. However, the government now requires that in the future there is a single tier of local government, with local authorities that will run all of these services. The problem is that the county council and the districts have different ideas about how things should be divided up. Councillors at Warwickshire County Council have decided they should form a new single unitary authority to cover the whole county. That was the conclusion of county councillors after 4 hours of debate at Shire Hall on Tuesday the 14th of October. The alternative approach is to split the county into two separate larger districts. The two council approach would see Warwick and Stratford merge in the south with Rugby, North Warwickshire and Nuneaton and Bedworth in the north. So far, Stratford, Warwick, North Warwickshire and Nuneaton and Bedworth have all expressed a preference for splitting the county in two. Rugby Borough Council is due to vote on the issue on the 19th of November. The government has set a guiding target of about 500,000 people per new council. The current population of Warwickshire is about 600,000. A final decision will ultimately be made by the government, with elections for the newly formed council, or councils, to be held in 2027. The new setup will then run as a shadow operation until taking full control in 2028. In considering the future, Warwickshire County Council has also voted to become part of the West Midlands Combined Authority. The Combined Authority is a group of local authorities, including Birmingham, Coventry, Dudley, Walsall, Sandwell, Solihull and Wolverhampton, which has devolved powers from the government to make decisions on strategic issues like transport and housing. The mechanism for extending the authority is not known. It is anticipated that if a single authority for Warwickshire is established, it will be accompanied by a move to set up town and parish councils with limited powers to cover the towns that have lost their councils.
Parents are being encouraged to ensure that their children receive flu vaccinations, perhaps during the half-term break, as infections surge. With temporary vaccination centres now opening at fire stations and even at bowling venues. NHS England confirmed that numerous pupils will have already been immunised at their schools, but opportunities remain available for those who have yet to receive protection. This push follows Health Chief's alerts about an unusually early flu season, with authorities pressing people to seek vaccination for their own safety and others. Temporary vaccination sites are also operating at places including football grounds and even local libraries. Local GP practices can provide flu vaccinations to school-aged children with specific medical conditions, as well as toddlers aged 2 and 3 years. Parents may also bring preschool children to chemists for immunisation, according to NHS England. Duncan Burton, Chief Nursing Officer for England, said, "It is hugely concerning that flu has hit us early this year, with a worrying increase among children. Flu can spread like wildfire across schools and can make children really unwell. The flu virus changes each year, so vaccination remains the best way to shield your child from getting seriously ill. That's why we're making it easier than ever for children to get the vaccine close to home or at school. So I'm urging parents to check their child's options for flu vaccination as soon as possible. Make sure you've opted your child in for their in-school vaccine or find your nearest community clinic. Influenza immunisations are additionally accessible for all individuals aged 65 and above, under 65s with vulnerable categories, care facility residents and their carers, expectant mothers, close contacts of immunocompromised individuals, and frontline healthcare and social care staff." Mr. Burton concluded, "Getting a flu jab takes only 5 minutes, and it can protect you from potentially serious health complications while supporting the NHS by reducing the number of people needing treatment during the immensely busy winter period."
Those of you who enjoy citrus fruits might want to pay attention to a nutrition expert's warning about a potential health hazard lurking in their peel. Jenny Tutcher, a Sunday Times number one best-selling author, says do check the labels on your easy peelers to see that they have been treated with. She brandished a packet of South African-grown mandarins purchased from a supermarket. "Don't grate the zest into your food and certainly don't cook the whole fruit, as you might be surprised at what they've been treated with. Citrus zest isn't always safe to eat," she went on to explain. "Many supermarket mandarins and tangerines are treated with surface fungicides to keep them fresh. These ones I found had been treated with 4 chemicals. Jenny proceeded to caution that regular consumption of such chemicals or exposure to high concentrations could affect your well-being in various ways. "Some can affect the liver and endocrine system," she said. "Others may cause irritation or metabolic effects, while others have been linked to possible hormonal and neurological effects." Fortunately, Jenny mentioned that regulatory bodies such as EFSA and FDA establish maximum residue limits, which aim to maintain these residues well below dangerous levels during typical consumption. But, she added, "the presumption is that you'll peel and eat the fruit. So don't use the zest nor eat the peel of those treated with these substances unless you wash and scrub thoroughly first. So peel before eating, wash and scrub well if using the zest, or choose organic fruit." In response to a TikTok user's query about needing zest, Jenny clarified, "You can either choose to wash them thoroughly or go for organic, which will have less and in some cases no fungicides." Meanwhile, Pesticide Action Network UK warned, "People are increasingly using the zest of citrus fruits. In addition, handling of fruit covered in fungicides, which are used to prevent food rotting, can mean absorption through the skin, which is a problem, particularly for children."
And now our second medical story. Healthcare in Coventry will be delivered closer to home. University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust will work with partners to deliver neighbourhood care after Coventry was selected to join the first wave of a new government programme, National Neighbourhood Health Implementation Programme. This programme aims to give people easier access to care and support to help them stay well. It will reduce unnecessary trips to hospital, freeing up appointments and beds for those who really need them. UHCW developed the bid, one of 43 chosen in the first phase, in partnership with the Coventry and Warwickshire Integrated Care Board, primary care colleagues, Coventry City Council and Coventry and Warwickshire Partnership Trust. The Trust says it will build on the Improving Lives programme launched in June 2024, which brought together health and social care teams to support people to lead independent, healthy lives. A programme leader will be appointed to work with existing services to help achieve the three key shifts of the government's 10-year health plan. These are hospital to community, analogue to digital, and sickness to prevention. A range of professions, including community nurses, hospital doctors, social care workers, pharmacists, dentists, optometrists, paramedics, social prescribers, local government organisations and the voluntary sector will work together to develop neighbourhood health teams. The teams will initially focus on supporting people with long-term conditions such as diabetes, arthritis, angina, high blood pressure, MS or epilepsy, in areas with the highest deprivation. But as the programme grows, it will expand to support other patients and other priorities.
Coventry City Council is stepping up its war on fly tipping with a £420,000 cash boost aimed at the city's worst hit areas. But residents are unconvinced that this will solve the problem. The money will fund a new rapid response fly tipping squad in Ball Hill, extra CCTV coverage at known dumping hotspots, and more street cleaning. Six new cameras will be added over the next 4 years, taking the total to 30, at an estimated cost of £80,000. In the past year alone, council teams have handled over 11,000 reports of fly tipping and investigated more than 3,000 cases. They've also issued orders for landowners to clear rubbish and tackle vermin, while fines for offenders have been increased from £200 to £1,000. Councillor Abdul Salam Khan said, "Fly tipping blights our communities and we are absolutely committed to tackling this issue head on. We are listening to residents' concerns and taking decisive action." Councillor Patricia Heatherton added, "Every day our amazing teams are out picking up rubbish and fly-tipped waste. It's a constant battle, but one we are determined to win. Fly-tipping is a real and persistent problem, and it's vital we find long-term solutions." The council says it will focus on both enforcement and education, working alongside community groups such as Destination Ball Hill and local litter pickers. It's also teaming up with West Midlands Police, the Fire Service and Citizen Housing, with clean-up projects already completed in Hillfields and Binley, with Wood End next on the list. One resident said, "Perhaps reducing the cost of the bulk item collection service would help. Due to the cost of living crisis, those on low incomes and pensioners may find the current £18.50 too much to pay, and they may not have transport to take things to the tip. If it's builders stroke contractors doing it, perhaps a £1,000 fine is not big enough deterrent. Also, the cameras are needed now, not in 4 years' time." But another disagrees. "The fee for bulk collections of household items is extremely good value, and there is no excuse for fly tipping. And one asks, how about letting people use the tip as required, instead of needing to make an appointment? That would help reduce fly tipping massively."
A pressure group tasked with preserving and promoting Coventry's heritage and history will not fight any plans to demolish the abandoned swimming baths, which have been empty for years. But they want a number of guarantees from the City Council about what will happen to the site and the Elephant Leisure Centre alongside it in Cox Street. back in August, the council said it would apply for permission to demolish the Grade 2 listed building after an extensive marketing campaign failed to find anyone interested in taking it over. It currently costs £400,000 each year to keep it secure, and now the Coventry Society has said it too can see no way forward for the building, which dates back to the 1960s. In a statement, the Coventry Society explained, "We, like many local organisations and Coventrians, are disappointed that the council wishes to demolish the swimming baths. Nevertheless, we recognise that there appears to be no viable reuse for the building. We agree with Historic England, who were responsible for the listing the swimming baths in 1997 as a Grade 2 building of architectural and historic interest, that the current cost of maintaining and securing the swimming baths and the elephant in a period of financial austerity for the council is not appropriate. Therefore, albeit with some reluctance, we will not oppose in principle the demolition of the baths. However, we do so with four caveats. Any application for listed building consent for demolition must include a clear statement on the long-term use of the elephant, a detailed and thorough report demonstrating that there is no alternative viable use for the swimming baths, a comprehensive study on the proposed future use of the site which rules out purpose-built student accommodation, and a statement on how the redevelopment and reuse of the site will take account of its sensitive location adjacent to the cathedral quarter. In conclusion, we demand that a high-quality proposal for the future use of the swimming baths site is brought forward so that Coventry and its citizens can be proud of the development in future decades. In the words of Historic England, it should strive to equal the civic ambition displayed in the central baths when they were first opened.
The Showcase Cinema in Coventry has been put up for sale after a major merger was completed in August, following which 16 UK locations are reportedly being sold. Owner National Amusements went up for sale following the recently completed merger between Paramount and Skydance Media. Reports indicate the deal is worth close to £6 billion. Paramount is set to be reorganised into three areas in an effort to make the business more streamlined. Studios, TV and direct-to-consumer offerings will each have their own division. Operators are now seeking to acquire Showcase Cinemas, which operate 816 sites across the UK, the USA, Argentina and Brazil. Key UK sites include Derby, Glasgow, Leeds, Coventry, Dudley, Leicester and Nottingham. Cinemas across the UK, including on Gielgud Way in Walsgrave, are expecting to be sold as part of the streamlining. Tickets for selected new releases, including After the Hunt and I Swear, were recently slashed to £4.99. In a statement, Showcase Cinemas said, "We are proud to be operating a strong and successful business at our Coventry site. Any future owner will be looking to build on this success and develop it further."
Work that started on the Clifford Bridge Road section of the new Bindley Cycleway is causing misery, say residents living there. Construction on the bike lane connecting Walsgrave to Bindley entered its second phase on Monday the 20th of October, reducing Clifford Bridge Road to one lane. As previously reported, the lane closure and subsequent road diversions are causing traffic chaos for residents and commuters in the area. But the repercussions are not just being felt on the roads, but in the houses themselves. "It's not just a traffic issue, it's the work itself," one resident said. "The noise and disruption are really upsetting people. The day the work started, one of my neighbours who works from home was in absolute tears because of the noise. I don't know what the rules are about noise levels, but it's certainly distressing. The vibration from the drills was so intense, it knocked things off their shelves." The resident added, "Six houses were blocked in with equipment. They couldn't get their cars out one evening. The workmen finish early and leave their machinery there. I don't even blame the workers, really. It's down to the council for not giving proper instructions. The work is expected to take up to 9 months to complete, so if this is your route to work, expect your journey to take a bit more time.
A major mixed-use site has been acquired in a significant new investment for Coventry. Earlston Park comprises various buildings occupied by several leading organisations, including Premier Inn. Situated on Butts Road, the 3.5-acre site includes a 100-bed Premier Inn, 23,000 square feet of Grade A offices, and the Albany Theatre. It also features a 72,000 square foot HQ-style office building and Earlston One. Tenants currently occupying Earlston Park are the Premier Inn, Found Ever GB, and Coventry City Council. Developer MCR Property Group are converting empty office space into flexible serviced workspace as part of a wider project. Sustainability upgrades and operational improvements are also planned for the building, while the sale price remains undisclosed. The site has recently been listed with Savills for £16.5 million. Martin Brown, Director of Commercial Property at MCR Property Group, said, "Coventry has all the right fundamentals, a skilled workforce, two thriving universities, and excellent transport links." He continued, "We see this as a cornerstone for our Midlands growth strategy and a platform for long-term regeneration. MCR recently acquired Corporation Village, Burgess House and Market Way." Mr. Brown said the acquisitions reflect a strategy to deliver high-quality residential, commercial and hospitality space in the West Midlands.
BT plans for next-generation telephone boxes in various areas of Coventry have been refused. They would have seen old telephone boxes replaced with hubs, which boast 5G connectivity, enable free public Wi-Fi use, and give people the chance to charge their devices whilst out and about. But it's reported that the BT wanted to install the New Street hubs in 13 parts of the city, but the council has refused a number of the applications. These include at Cross Cheaping, Little Park Street, Gosford Street, Far Gosford Street, Remembrance Road, Belgrade Square, Foswell Road, Priory Place, Binley Road, Belgrade Plaza, Jordan Well and Fairfax Street. The decisions report explains that in some cases the proposed hubs would impact on the street scene due to their appearance and that they would add to the street clutter.
Some of the unbelievable 999 calls made to Warwickshire's fire service have been revealed. The lighter side of what is a very serious job has been shared by Warwickshire Fire and Rescue Service. One includes how they had to advise a caller who had a hamster trapped in a dishwasher to isolate the power. This led to what has been described as hilarious radio message. "Crews have successfully rescued one hamster from dishwasher, thoroughly squeaky clean and appears okay." Another call involved a unique animal rescue, assisting a crew to safely retrieve a three-legged cat that had climbed a tree and couldn't get down. The fire service has revealed the details of the work of its control room operators on the eve of International Control Room Week, which runs from last Monday to Sunday. From January the 1st to September the 30th this year, the fire service's control room received 38,581 calls in total. Paying tribute to the staff, Councillor Dale Bridgewater said, "The control room staff are, without question, the crucial link in every emergency. They face incredibly challenging and high-pressure situations, making split-second decisions to support the safety of our communities. I am honoured to be visiting the team to personally extend my thanks. Their professionalism is truly inspiring, and they deserve every bit of recognition this week brings."
And now, just in time for Halloween, specialists at Warwick Castle have devised a novel strategy to tackle the seven ghosts that reportedly haunt its corridors. The castle's ghostorians have developed a new wraith-repellent scare freshener fragrance, using traditional ghost-busting scents to combat spectral activity. It's believed that restless spirits wander the castle grounds, with seven distinct apparitions said to frequent its halls. These include a little girl in white, a towering shadow man, and Moll Bloxam, a former servant of the Earl of Warwick. Moreover, it's claimed that a phantom army marches towards the castle during the evening of October the 23rd every year. The newly created sea salt and sage fragrance is designed to dispel unwanted negative energy and is now available for purchase to purify visitors' homes as well. The key ingredients in the fragrance are sage, traditionally used for smudging to cleanse the air of bad energy, and sea salt, known for its purifying properties and ability to create barriers to stop demons from crossing certain boundaries like doorways and windowsills. Mm-hmm. While much of this may be conjecture, there are eerie facts about Warwick Castle that can be observed today. These include two anti-witch markings etched into the towers to prevent witches from gaining entry. Mark Rennett, Warwick Castle's chief ghostorian, said, "Warwick Castle is steeped in spooky history. Throughout the ages, UK residents have been determined to ward off evil beings. Medieval English were more wary of demons than witches, but after the first Witchcraft Act came into effect in 1541, a witch craze swept across England and Europe. During the Tudor period, beds became shorter so people could sleep upright so they wouldn't be confused for those who'd passed away and their souls stolen by witches. In the Victorian era, there was a nationwide obsession with ghost hunting and holding seances, a tradition that still carries on today at Warwick Castle. Featuring the mineral-rich aroma of sea salt and the sweet scent of sage, we hope that our wraith repellent helps this Halloween."
And to end, another haunted house story. Workers at a 15th century Cotswold manor made a spine-chilling discovery when they found a hidden chamber containing the skeletons of a man seated at a table and a dog at his feet. The skeleton remains of Francis Lovell were found eerily upright at a table, surrounded by books, paper and pens, as if frozen in time, leaving his cause of death shrouded in mystery. Eerie whispers continued to circulate centuries later that Francis and his loyal canine companion still haunt the ruins of Minster Lovell Hall, nestled beside the River Rindrush in Oxfordshire. Cotswolds.com describes Minster Lovell as the region's most haunted village, largely due to the ghostly apparitions of the Lovell family, who are rumoured to frequent the area long after their demise. The hall was built in the 1430s on the site of an older building by William, 7th Baron Lovell, a veteran of the renowned Battle of Agincourt. He also revamped the village church, believed to be his final resting place, although there is no inscription or documentary evidence to substantiate this claim. According to History UK, Francis, William's grandson, stayed there until the builders discovered an underground vault and his skeletal remains during renovation work in 1708. But Francis wasn't the sole casualty at the hall. Cotswold Journey states that William's bride disappeared during a game of hide-and-seek on her wedding night, never to be found again. Then, years later, a servant uncovered the body of a young woman dressed in bridal clothing, preserved in a lead-lined chest used for storing food. One individual who claims he's had a direct encounter with supernatural activity at Minster Lovell is Jonathan, who wrote on Darkling Room that he experienced a strange atmosphere upon entering the hall's dovecot. Jonathan said, "Upon entering, we were both immediately aware of the strange atmosphere around us. The bright daylight was gone, and an eerie atmosphere was enhanced by the dusky hues within, and all was quiet. Spooky."
Outlook News.
Thanks to our newsreaders, Elaine and Peter. Now, I hope you managed to put the clocks back, because sunrise is now at 7 a.m. and sunset is 4:52 p.m. Winter draws on, as they say.
It really does.
And here's you to give us an update from the hub.
I hate it when it gets dark in the evenings, I have to say. I much prefer the lighter evenings. And anyway, never mind. That's the way the world turns, isn't it, I suppose? Right, we have an embarrassing amount of CCTV screen readers here at the moment. So these are the large desktop magnifiers, digital magnifiers. Some people find them extremely useful, and some people, you know, don't get on with them quite so well. And we try and pass them on, but I have an embarrassment of them at the moment. I've got 7, and they take up quite a lot of room, which is one of the reasons why some people don't like them at home. But anyway, they sit on if you've got a studio, a study or a desk area where you could have a permanent one of these, and you think you might like one, do come and have a chat with me. Some of the older ones that we've got are just £50. I've got one that's a bit more expensive at £100, and then I've got one which is practically new. It's an Optelec Clearview C that is about a year and a half old and was barely used. Now, new, these sell at about £2,200. This one I'm willing to let go for £1,000. So if you really want a CCTV screen reader, then I say we have a range of price options available, and so do give us a call on 024 7671 7522 to come in and have a chat with me about them, and I will show them to you. I had to take some of them up to the loft. There were that many of them, so we'll have to get them down from the loft as well if you want to have a look at some of them. I'm in the process of looking at how we modernise our sign-in system here at the Vision Hub. We're looking to move to a digital system. Now, this would not be a system that you guys would necessarily use. We, for those of you who come into the hub, it would be a screen that the people on reception would use, type in your name, etc., and get you signed in that way. The system I'm looking at requires an iPad. Now, I thought I had an old iPad that I could just test the system on. I'm going to need to use a much bigger one if we do take it on. I'm just wondering if anyone out there may have an old iPad that they're not using, sort of tucked away in a drawer. The one that I had just does not work. So if anybody wouldn't mind lending one to me for a couple of weeks, I would be very pleased about that. Perhaps you could give us a call on the number and let me know, and then I could come and pick it up. Or if you come into the centre regularly, then it would be very kind of you to bring that in so that I could have a little fiddle. I'd need to download an app onto it and do various things. So preferably an old one that you might have tucked away in a drawer somewhere. So thank you very much for that. Now, I just want to clear up a little bit of confusion. Now, on Monday morning, we have an accessible voting workshop. So that's on Monday, the 3rd of November, this coming Monday, that is taking place in the Mary Beale Room. And which you're most welcome to attend. This is a workshop that's being organised by the RNIB and by Coventry City Council to explain what accessible voting technology there is out there, your rights, how you can vote more privately, all those sorts of things. And it's going to start at 10 o'clock, I think, on Monday. Monday Club is still happening, and Monday Club is happening in Boston Lodge, in the normal room where you've been forever. There's a number of people who've been saying, oh, well, are we going back into the Mary Beale Room? It's like, no, you're not this week. So Monday Club will be happening, but in Boston Lodge, in the normal room, unless you want to go to the voting accessible voting workshop, in which case you may toddle along to the Mary Beale room and sit in on that. Okay, so I hope that's nice and clear now, and we will be directing people on Monday morning to the appropriate location for what they want to do. Now, we have coming up the Winter Warmer, which is going to be taking place on Saturday the 29th of November, and it'll kick off at 11 a.m. and finish by 3. We're going to have all the usual things like pork batches, pork and stuffing batches, soup. Yes, my pumpkin crop this year has been excellent, so there will definitely be pumpkin soup. There'll probably be another flavour as well, because not everybody likes pumpkin. There will be teas and coffees and all the usual things. We are looking for people to make cake, so if you know, or if you can yourself, or if you know anybody else who can make cakes for sale, either in the cafe or on the table, that would be good. Same thing with jams. I've been donating some jams myself. I've been raiding my cupboard, which is very full of jams made from our produce this year, and I know Marjorie will be bringing loads of jams as usual, so which always sell very well. That would be good. We're also looking out for raffle and tombola prizes, so tombola in particular, bottle shaped things or smallish things that will go into bottle bags or small gift bags. That would be great, thank you very much. If you would be kind enough to donate, those donations would be very gratefully received. We've also now found out that we will be entertained, I'm pleased to say, by the choir of Earlston Primary School, which will be coming at 1:15 p.m. To entertain us all. Now, depending on the weather, and we hope the weather will be better this year than it was last, but it being December, you really can't guarantee it. Mind you, we wouldn't be able to guarantee it in July either, but we are hoping that we might be able to have a few things outside. So we may have a few stalls outside, and the charity shop will be open, and we hope that bits of that might be able to be outside as well. Let's hope for one of those cold, crisp, clear days, as opposed to today's Wednesday, as I speak, miserable wetness that it has been all day. Looking out for the Winter Warmer. If you want to come in on the bus, we have a list for people who like to be brought in with the bus. So give us a call and get your name onto there if that is what you would like to do. Finally, I'm just going to warn you about the Christmas closing times. So you'll know that every year that we close at Christmas, we are going to close on Christmas Eve this year, like we have done over the last many years, actually. So our last day of groups will be on the Tuesday, the 23rd. So that will be the last day. And then because the 2nd of January, which would be the normal sort of first working day, is a Friday, and it's not going to be, so we're not going to open on that Friday. It's a bit of an orphan day. So we're going to go then, and we shall reopen on Monday the 5th of January. So we shall be closed on the 23rd of December and reopen on the 5th of January. And so that's your pre-warning there for Christmas. Okay. And I think that's about it for this week. There's probably loads that I haven't talked about.
How did the theatre trip go?
Oh, the theatre trip went splendidly. Thank you very much. Everybody thoroughly enjoyed themselves. We had fish and chips to start with, and before we all went off and did a touch tour at a new theatre company to us, the Saints Drama down in Alsley Village, and everybody thoroughly enjoyed themselves for the whole evening. So, and I managed to get up and talk a little bit about the charity as well. They are going to be coming in at some point and giving us some money, because they raised a whole bunch of money for us on their raffles, their evening raffles. So so we're looking forward to welcoming them up here, and we will take a picture and put that up on the Facebook page.
Lovely, thank you. I've got a feeling I've got an iPad in a drawer.
Oh, good man. Okay, well, have a look, yes, and let me know. I'd be very grateful.
Yes, be careful what you wish for.
But yes, I could end up with 10, couldn't I?
Thank you.
Here is a very jubilant Sarah with the sport news.
Well, hello there again, lovely, 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 lovely listeners. Yes, it's Sarah here with sport. Now I'm going to start off as usual with football. Well, when I left you last week, Coventry were top of the league, the championship. But could that last? We got two matches in 5 days. Again, so we played Portsmouth on Tuesday away. Now, many of us remember the thumping we had last year when we lost 4-1, having led 1-0 at one stage. Well, I'm afraid 2 goals by Brandon Thomas-Asante meant that Coventry led 2-0 by halfway through the second half. Could we relax? At that point, all attention turned to our goalie, Carl Rushford. He was up for a record as the leading Coventry goalie ever not to concede a goal consecutively. The record then stood at 613 minutes. Well, we needn't have worried. Bit by bit, he ticked off the top five on the list, which included Les Seeley, Rhys Charles Cook, the mighty Steve Grizovich, and somebody from 1930 who I'd never heard of, and I can't recall his name. But he set a new record since the club began of 623 minutes. Now, it's only 623 because in injury time, I'm afraid, he did concede a goal. But Portsmouth had got nearly all their players up in the city half anyway. They got absolutely nothing to lose. So, happy journey back for all of our city fans from Portsmouth. Still top of that league until we faced Watford on Saturday at home. Now, Watford are slippery customers. In fact, I remember a 4-0 drubbing when it was due to be Marcus Hall's last game. Gosh, that seems like an age ago. Well, after 4 minutes, we were calmed a little by a lovely three-man act. Carl Rushford, the goalie, long goal kick, straight out to Tak Sakamoto, who did a fantastic run and a strike to meet the waiting head of, you've guessed who, young Brandon Thomas-Asante. City 1-0 up. It got even better 6 minutes later. Another goal to City, thanks to a long throw-in from our Dutchman, Milan van Avak, straight to Jamie Allen, who was only playing because Victor Torp had got a calf strain, and yet young Jamie fired a torpedo into the net. 2 goals up. Could this last? Well, it lasted until the 42nd minute when Tak Sakamoto went alone and made it 3-0. Even better, in injury time, Watford had a player sent off. So we went in at half time, 3-0 up, playing an opposition with only 10 men on the pitch. Now, I love this quote from Steve Grizovich at half time. He said, quote, Watford's main problem is that they're like Real Madrid up front, but they've got nothing in defence. Absolutely. Couldn't have put it better myself, Steve. Now, about halfway through the second half, unfortunately, Carl Rushford gave away a penalty, which he then let in. So the final score was Coventry 3, Watford 1. And guess what? We're still top of that league. Oh, yes, we are. We have 28 points from 12 matches, a goal difference of an amazing plus 25. We've had 6 successive victories. Now, to put that in context, leading the pack, chasing us, yes, chasing us, don't you know, is Middlesbrough, who are 3 points behind and have a goal difference of a paltry +7. So we basically have 2 matches in hand. Now, before I speak to you next week, City will have played, well, they'll have played 2 matches, but I'll only be able to comment on the one because the second match is on the Tuesday. But this coming Friday, Halloween, for those of you who follow it, which I don't, we are away at Wrexham, 8 p.m. kickoff. Then the following Tuesday, we are at home to Sheffield United. And that's the concert that's really been spiked up by the fact that the enemy, the pop group, the enemy, not the United fans, now, are going to perform We Live and Die in This Town, which has become our second anthem. Now, all the good news on football stops there, I'm afraid. In our men's non-league teams, both Leamington and Stratford were away. Leamington lost 1-0 to Oxford City. And Stratford, I'm not sure who they were playing, but I heard that they were thumped 4-0. And the women's game doesn't get any better either. In a friendly international, England lost to Brazil 2-1. Despite Brazil going down to 10 women just before half time. And I'm afraid it was the FA Cup first round on Sunday, and all 3 of our local sides were beaten. Rugby Borough lost away to Wolverhampton Wanderers 2-1. Coventry Sphinx were at home to Derby, but were thumped 6-0. And Joe's favourite club, Camden Court, also lost away to Royston Town 1-0. And I'm afraid it couldn't get any better for our rugby lads. No. Although they were playing at home at Butts Park Arena, they were playing last year's title winners, Ealing Trailfinders, and I'm afraid were lost 36 points to 63. Come on, Cov, you've got to start winning again. Now, turning to a couple of sports which are slightly more cheerful, though on the national stage, I know, not the local. F1, Formula One, the Grand Prix. Now, the Sunday, a fortnight ago probably, as you're listening to this, we had the American Grand Prix in Texas. And at that point, the title race, which had seen very much a carve-up for Oscar Piastri, possibly with Lando Norris in second, became a 3-horse race when, I'm afraid, Max Verstappen won yet another Grand Prix. Second was Lando Norris, third Charles Leclerc, and then Lewis Hamilton pushed Oscar Piastri back into fifth place. So although Oscar led, his points total was gradually getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, this week we have the Mexican Grand Prix in Mexico City, and that absolutely smashed wide open this title race. The race itself was won by Lando, with Charles Leclerc in second and Max Verstappen in third, and again Oscar Piastri was fifth or sixth, and he's now been overtaken by the British man Lando Norris, who leads the table albeit just by 1 point. But rather ominously, Max Verstappen is lurking in third place within touching distance. Come on, Max, have a year off. Go on. Now, cricket, it gets even better. And yes, I am using the words even better and cricket. I'm going back to the Women's World Cup ODI, the one-day match. Well, despite getting their first loss in the round-robin stage, we lost to Australia, don't you know? England are through to the semi-finals. Oh, by the way, they absolutely destroyed New Zealand. So in the semi-finals, we have Australia, who qualified first, and will play India, who qualified fourth. And then England qualified second versus South Africa, who qualified third. Now, given that England absolutely tore South Africa apart in the round robin stage, let's hope and keep our fingers crossed that they're in that final. Now, although the semis will have been played by the time you're listening to this, the final is on Sunday, Sunday, November the 2nd at 9:30 a.m. And finally, now I'm going to do quite a long build-up to explain this. I'm going back to football. I told you that Coventry were travelling to Wrexham on Friday. Well, Coventry City, of course, have a manager called Frank Lampard. That's stage one. Stage two is that Wrexham are bankrolled and were bought up and have been transformed to back-to-back-to-back promotions by a couple of Hollywood actors who've done huge things for the city of Wrexham as well. So is this match being called by CWR? Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And on that point, I wish you a very good week ahead, and may your team also, unless you're in the championship, be top of that league.
Yes, it's great to see the Sky Blues doing so well, but if they get promoted in May, I think we will have to tie her down with sandbags. She is one happy bunny at the moment. And now here's Dave with this week's postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello and welcome to your postbag. Now we begin with a lovely descriptive message from Mary Hart about the lovely smells from next door's garden that guide her to her home.
Hello, Mary Hart. Now I live about 10 minutes from a bus stop and up a hill. So after, if I've been out for a while, a fairly long day and an afternoon. Again, I'm reaching home. I'm feeling pretty tired. And really, all I want is a nice cup of coffee and a sit down. But fortunately, a few doors away from where I live, the lady has planted a whole set of lavender bushes all along her wall. So as I pass by, just wanting to sit down and my coffee, I run my hand all along her lovely lavender bushes. Such a beautiful smell. Aroma, they're too lovely to call them smell. And take a deep breath. They give such a boost to my last few steps home. Fortunately, now they've died off. So what I could do, take a nice sprig of my rosemary bush and put it in my pocket. Then I can sniff it all the way from the bus stop. Nature's balm, hey? Beautiful. Bye.
Thank you, Mary. You really have a lovely way of describing things. You can almost smell the lavender. Now, Jag Singh is guided to his front door by solar lights. Here he is to tell you more.
Hi, everybody. It's Jag Singh here. And I thought I'd share a useful thing that I've done recently. Now, with the darker evenings, it's a little bit hard, especially if you've got poor eyesight, to look for markers of where your house is, where steps are, and these things. It's easier to trip up and hurt yourself in the dark. So I went to B&Q, the one on Holyhead Road, and I purchased solar LED rock lights. They're only £4 each. They're about sort of 3 inches by 3 inches, because they're the LED lights. They're really bright white lights. So I've put some alongside my driveway, so it sort of lights up where I'm going. Just gives my eyes something to focus on, so I know I'm heading in the right direction. I've put a couple either side of my front door. So again, it just gives you something to focus on, and when it's dark, these things help, the act as markers. And in my garden, I've got some steps which lead onto the lawn, and I've just put one on the end of each step. So again, they act as markers, so I know what I'm aiming for. They're not particularly expensive, solar powered. You can move them around. Brilliant things, and they've definitely made my life easier, especially as we're having these darker nights. So they're called solar-powered LED rock lights, and I bought them from B&Q on Holyhead Road for £4 each. Take care, everybody.
Thank you, Jag, for another great piece of helpful information. Tell us if you have solar lights in your garden. The batteries of solar lights don't seem to last forever, but they look really nice while they last. My late brother had a big flower tub packed full of solar lights, and they lit up like Blackpool illuminations at night. He told me that he was aiming for the world record, currently held by A. Nerd of Tooting. I inherited his little plastic animals that sit on the kitchen windowsill and wave their paws, fins and heads and bottoms while there is daylight. And I've got a lovely archway in the garden which has solar lights round, and sometimes they come on when it's been sun shining a lot. And now Graham wishes to correct a phone number to ring for help if you're travelling by train. First, he talks about the quality of his postbag messages.
Well, first of all, having listened to my recording recorded on a mobile phone, I am not convinced that it is any better on a mobile phone. In fact, I think it sounds worse to me. But anyway, just to correct something which went out on that, the Virgin Journey Care number which I read out there is no longer up and running. You cannot get through on that number anymore. In fact, I'm not even sure whether Virgin even run trains these days. And the number which I gave was not for West Coast. It's actually run by Great Western Railway, though I'm sure they will deal with the Journey Care wherever you are in the country. But their number is 0800 197 1329. But there is also a National Rail inquiry number, customer service number I should say, which don't actually advertise Journey Care, but I have got onto them and asked where I go to if I want to book Journey Care, and they say they can do it. And I think this is the number which probably Dave gave. I can't remember now, but I'll give it anyway, just in case it wasn't. It is 0800 223720. That's National Railway Customer Service. You will also book your care if you wish, I'm told, on 08000 223720. I hope I've got the numbers all right. After all that, they're all 11-digit numbers. But I'm not convinced that my recordings are any better on a mobile phone. So I shall go back to the landline. Well, I am. I'm talking to you on the landline now.
Thank you, Graham. I rang the number you gave on 08000 223720. And the lady told me to ring the passenger assistance team on 03455 280 253. The phone number Robert Franklin gave out was for Avanti West Coast, because he likes going to Tynmouth. I hope that helps. Elizabeth has been on a theatre outing to the Saints Drama Group's latest production at Aldsley Village Hall, where they had a raffle at every performance in aid of Coventry Vision Hub. Here she is to talk about the play.
Hi everyone. I begin this week with a rare treat for theatre-goers. We attended a performance by the Saints Drama Group based in Aldsley. The play was entitled Tales from the Cursed House and was quite spellbinding. The acting was brilliant. Set over several timelines from 1974, 1981, 1994, 2003, 2014, 2019, and finally 2025, we saw the fate of the occupants of the house, the dastardly way they came to an untimely end. A superb evening. Many thanks to the Saints.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for another great report, so beautifully written and read. Glad to hear you getting out and about. I went to see it two nights earlier with friends John and Barbara and the Greyfriars group, which is a bit of an arts and sort of culture group. It's a friendly and intimate theatre with tea and biscuits given out during the interval. On this occasion, the lady helping to pass the tea around was the woman playing the murderess with a poison cup of tea. The Saints put on three shows a year and they're really good and worth going along to and supporting. And that's your lot for this week in Postbag. Thank you very much. Like acting in a play, you are giving us great performances too. After all, as a great playwright once said, all the world's a stage and we are merely players. Keep playing and sharing your talents and experiences with your fellow listeners. And ring us up on the postbag, answer phone on 024 76 717 522, and press 5 for Coventry Talking Newspaper and leaving a message. And you can ring me up if you want, 024 76 598484, and you can have a chat with me and record something if you wish. If I'm not in, please leave your name and phone number so I can get back to you, or send a letter, either written by you or someone on your behalf. You can send us an email at postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk, or you can send me an email if you want. That's davidmonks46@gmail.com. But there you are. So anyway, just please, let's hear from you. Okay, there's lots of things we can talk about. Things that might have interested you on Outlook, including the news, or helpful tips, or where you've been for your holiday. Things like that. Okay, thanks a lot. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
Thanks to Dave for this week's Postbag. It's always good to hear from you. Now, Elaine is going about as far north as she can in Warwickshire. She's going to the village of No Man's Heath.
No Man's Heath is a small village on the B5493, with a short but interesting history. Before the 19th century, No Man's Heath was heathland, which belonged to neither of the adjoining parishes. A community of squatters developed, and the church was built in 1863. By 1871, the population was 122. Some residents still remember the mud hut, a thatched one-story cottage that stood where the community centre now is, and the church is now closed. The main road from Tamworth to Ashby lost its status as an A route following the opening of the M42. The village has a petrol station on the main road and two garages for vehicle repairs. One of the first residents of No Man's Heath was Joe Leavesley, a leper. He worked as a coal heaver and a former Newton Regis resident. Thomas Riley, born 1847, who remembered him, described him thus: "How I looked with dread at the poor man's arm, inflamed and scaly, as with sleeve turned up he went about his work as a coal heaver, with his horse and cart." He goes on, "He was the first, I believe, to build a hut on No Man's Heath, on the heath itself, not on the fringe of it, in defiance of a neighbouring squire." The public house, The Four Counties, records the fact that No Man's Heath used to be the meeting point for the four counties of Warwickshire, Staffordshire, Leicestershire and Derbyshire. The border of Derbyshire has now moved a few miles away, but this heathland became a convenient escape route for fugitives from the law to cross over into a neighbouring county and so evade capture. It was also the site of many prize fights in the 19th century, perhaps for the same reason.
Thanks. Now, Anne Cleves is the queen of detective novels, thrilling millions of readers and TV viewers through her two series Vera and Shetland. Now she reveals why she's heading back up north again. This is taken from the Sunday Express, is written by Jan Coates and is read by Margaret.
Best-selling author Anne Cleves decided to bring back one of her most beloved detectives in a new series because she was homesick for Britain's Northern Isles. Detective Inspector Jimmy Perez, last featured in Anne's 2018 thriller Wildfire, which she felt was a fitting end to his story after the sudden death of her husband Tim from a heart condition in December 2017. She had met respected ornithologist Tim while working for a summer as an assistant cook at an observatory on Fair Isle, the southernmost Shetland Isle, 50 years ago. After his death, she said it would be too painful to write any more books in her Shetland series, as after spending so much time on the Scottish Islands with the man she loved, he was an intrinsic part of it. But her love of the wild and remote islands and fond memories of spending time with the people living there with him have now drawn her back with a new thriller set on Orkney, The Killing Stones. This sees Jimmy living with his partner Willow and their young son on the main Orkney island when he is called out in a violent storm after childhood friend Archie Stout goes missing. The detective, portrayed by actor Dougie Henshaw, 59, in a popular TV adaptation for 7 series until 2022, finds his friend dead from a blow to the head with a Neolithic stone carved with Viking runes and vows to bring the killer to justice. Anne said, Wildfire was going to be the very last Jimmy Perez. 8 books, that was enough. But I get kind of homesick for the Northern Isles. I really wanted to go north again. I was haunted by it in a way, wanting to be back on the islands. And it is 50 years since I first went to Fair Isle, so I've recently been back and it was a bit special for the launch of a new bird observatory there. She adds, it was 50 years ago I first met Tim on Fair Isle. I had dropped out of university and was living in a bedsit in Putney, working for Camden Social Services, because I had done a gap year working for them, so I went back and got a job with them. But I'm not a city person at all, and I did not really like to be in London in a bedsit in the same house with a guy we all thought was really weird because he was a birder. He was going off to be the assistant warden in the observatory on Fair Isle. I did not really know him that well, but I went to the pub to say goodbye to him, and he was moaning about what a wet and miserable place it was, because he had been dumped by his girlfriend, so he was just generally miserable. And I said I would not mind spending a summer on Fair Isle without even knowing where it was. But he said, if you are serious, they are desperate for an assistant cook. So off I went, which is what you do when you're 19 or 20. Tim went as a visiting bird watcher, and when they both returned to Shetland for the following summer and were helping the islanders with their hay baling, he proposed to her. Anne, 70, says, the last Shetland book coincided with him dying, so that's why I decided not to do any more. The time that had passed has changed this, and the new series is also a celebration of the people there. People I thought were old then now don't seem so old. It was fabulous to go back and catch up with people who were there when I first went to Shetland. Some were young parents at the time. She adds it is also 50 years since she first went to Orkney to stay with a friend she met while working on Fair Isle. So she relished spending time there researching her latest novel, which is the start of a new series. Anne said, that was in midwinter at the end of 2023, and it was clear and frosty and absolutely beautiful. There is no other reason for bringing Jimmy Perez back now other than I wanted to go north again, and in the last Shetland book, Wildfire, he had moved with Willow to Orkney. So I thought it would be quite fun to see them together as a family, because we've not done that, and see him with her as his boss, really. It grew out of that. She adds, Killing Stones is about families again. I write a lot about families, and if you live in Orkney or Shetland, it's very hard because you are very close to people, but you also want to keep part of your life private. So there are those secrets that people know but don't talk about, and I quite enjoy exploring those things. When asked if there could be a TV adaptation of a new Orkney series with Perez having been replaced by Ashley Jensen's D.I. Ruth Calder in the BBC drama Shetland, which has been continued independently of her books, Anne says, I don't think anyone else could play Jimmy in a TV adaptation because Dougie was just as so iconic, and it would just be a bit greedy to have another TV series, wouldn't it? But Vera is not on TV now, so it's up to them, Silverprint, the production company behind the Shetland and Vera TV versions. If they fancy it, that would be wonderful. Orkney would love it. Anne, who lives in Whitley Bay, also created Vera Stanhope, the detective brought to life by Brenda Blethyn, 79, in a long-running ITV drama which ended in January. She says, it feels weird not to have Vera back filming, as it was a lot easier for me to go on set in Northumberland than it was to go up to Shetland. It was like order being restored, Vera coming back for filming, and the people in the North East loved it. They would all come out and watch. After saying that last year's Vera novel, The Dark Wives, would be the end of the series, coinciding with the TV series finishing, Anna's now decided to write another one. She says, "Last year I thought I had probably written enough Vera with the TV series ending, but I've introduced a new character, Rosie Bell. If I want to go back and be in the Northeast again, I might focus on her, so I'm leaving it open to potentially doing more books set in Northumberland. The new Vera will come out in 2027. I'm planning to write more books with Jimmy on Orkney, and because Willow is in charge of all the Scottish islands, we could go and do something in North Uist, as she is originally from the Hebrides, so that would be fun. I'll stick to Orkney for a bit." Anne's third book series, featuring Detective Matthew Venn, is set in North Devon, where she grew up and reunited with a friendship of a child after losing Tim. Its third instalment is due to come out next year, but she's remaining tight-lipped about the plot. With Anne's writing allowing her to spend time in the places she loves, the Northern Isles, Northumberland and Devon, she's no plans to reduce her prolific output. "I love writing books," she says. "I get up in the morning and look forward to telling stories. That is what gets me out of bed. The festivals and touring are tiring, but that's just a few weeks and the payback is being paid to tell stories."
Now, small but mighty. This is the story of olives, all about their origins and their century-old traditions. This is taken from the Waitrose Food Magazine and is read by Nigel.
"Plump and green with a cold glass of wine, salty and black tossed through a pasta or peppery drizzle of oil on a tomato salad, nothing evokes sunset vibes quite like the olive. But these tiny fruits are more than just the calling card of the Mediterranean diet. They're embedded in the area's psyche, culture and way of life. Olives are among the oldest cultivated crops in the world, originating in the eastern Mediterranean at least 6,000 years ago. The trees flourish where almost nothing else will, on sun-baked hillsides, in salty winds, and on the leanest, most uncompromising soils. And so they are being planted throughout the region from the groves of Crete to the coastal area of Turkey. They grow at a leisurely pace, taking a few years to bear fruit, but then continue to live and produce for decades, often centuries. The trees in the Garden of Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem are thought to be more than 900 years old. Olives demand and then reward patience. The fruits are hard and bitter straight from the branch, yet, coaxed by time, salt and tradition, they yield a savoury, briny flavour and oil that glows like greenish gold. It is this alchemy from bitterness to brilliance that has earned them such reverence. Olives are rooted not just in the soil, but also in the history and symbolism of the Mediterranean. In ancient Greece, victors of the Olympic Games were crowned with olive leaves. Athena won the favour of Athens by offering its citizens the first olive tree. In Islam, the tree symbolises purity and goodness, and the olive is spoken of in the Quran as a blessed fruit. And, of course, in the story of Noah, the dove's olive twig was the first sign of life after the flood, the olive as hope in plant form. But olives have endured mostly because they and their oil are delicious. Their flavour speaks of summer, of heat and shade, stone and salt. They are endlessly diverse in variety, the character of the land in which they grow, the moment of harvesting, and the method of preservation. Big, buttery, apple-green Nocalara olives from Sicily, Moroccan Beldi olives picked late, dry-cured in salt before being soaked in oil, rich and reminiscent of sun-dried tomatoes, and deep purple-red Kalamata olives from the shores of the Aegean, with their creamy texture and fruity flavour. Each tells the story of its origin, capturing a landscape, climate and tradition. The olive offers us something for every season, as happy as a salty counterpoint to slow-cooked winter meals or braised root vegetables, as it's served warm with spices and citrus peel alongside a simple aperitivo. But it is in summer when they are most transporting. Throw a few into a Greek salad and eat in the sunshine, and you are instantly on the harbour in Skiathos. Combine a handful of salted summer tomatoes and soak up the combined juices with thick, fresh bread, and you are under a pergola in a French vineyard. Whether picked up at a Provençal market or spooned from a jar in a British kitchen, olives always bring the Mediterranean with them. Its warmth, its slowness, its sunlit generosity. It's tempting to call them humble, these little fruits with their tough skins and unlikely bitter beginnings, but olives are a cornerstone of Mediterranean civilization, a tiny triumph that has been fought over, celebrated, and become a mainstay of kitchens around the world.
Are you terrified of spiders? Well, if you are, Gabby Hoddard told the Mail on Sunday that she's found the cure as a result of going on London Zoo's friendly spider competition. This is read by Elaine.
Nothing can prepare you for the physical ache of being separated from your child for months at a time. It doesn't matter if that child doesn't still fit on your lap. And I miss my 23-year-old daughter, Juliet, every day, says Gabby. At the start of this year, she moved 10,000 miles away to Australia's Gold Coast with her boyfriend on a 2-year working visa. I thought her dad and I could cope with the separation by planning a visit. Then came the phone call. Mum, we've got a massive golden orb spider in our backyard. It just sits there in its web all day. Before she'd even got the first sentence out, I'd started to hyperventilate. I couldn't concentrate on any of her other news. I love my daughter more than anything, but my arachnophobia was firmly in charge. Ever since childhood, I've had a fear of spiders, and even now, in my 50s, I've never been able to remove one from my house. Of course, it's irrational. Very rarely has anyone been carried to their doom by a spider. And the 27 million strong population of Australia are happily going about their business. So facing the prospect of not being able to see my daughter, I decided it was time to get a grip and enrolled on the zoo's friendly spider programme. The zoo runs this course 8 times a year, each time welcoming 45 participants, an indication of just how widespread arachnophobia is. Indeed, estimates suggest that up to 15% of the world's population are sufferers. On my course are women and men of all ages from across the UK. One participant has even flown in from Hamburg for it. None of this surprises friendly spider programme leader and arachnid expert Dave Clark. We've been running the programme since 1993, and more than 5,000 people have been through it. People of all ages come. Our eldest was 90, and although there are more women than men, arachnophobia affects everybody. I buddy up with retiree Tim Williamson, age 70, from Chichester, and like me, desperate to kick the phobia. He remembers the moment his started, when he was a toddler and his arachnophobic mum screamed at him to run away as he had a spider crawling on his back. His condition was so bad that once while driving he spotted a money spider dangling from the roof and crashed the car. Dave Clark promises us that the course achieves a 97% success rate, which is measured by the number of participants able to achieve a catch and release exercise at the end of the day, meaning they can trap and remove an ordinary house spider without harming it.
That's our measure of success, he says, because this is about conservation. We want everyone to be able to put spiders outside rather than killing them. The four-hour course begins with a welcome from John Clifford, a hypnotherapist, who's been working on the programme since 2001. He explains how arachnophobia is usually learned behaviour, handed down from a parent or carer, though it can also simply develop organically in some people. He also says that 90% of the mind is unconscious, simply reacting to the conscious part of the brain. And if a wrong idea, such as fear of spiders, gets lodged in this part, the unconscious mind reacts accordingly. His matter-of-fact explanation is encouraging, as is his confidence that he can rewire our thinking. He then gets everyone discussing what they dislike about spiders, such as too many legs, too many eyes, too hairy. It turns into a humorous chat, and he will later explain that getting everyone relaxed and laughing is key to the success of the course, because arachnophobes are usually very serious when thinking about spiders. By using humour, we open up different pathways in participants' brains. Clark then explains that of 50,000 species of spider in the world, only 4 give a nasty bite, while all 666 species in the UK are harmless. We're provided with a pillow and told to lie on the floor and relax. Clifford uses group hypnosis to put us into a deeply restful state. We close our eyes and are instructed to think about going down steps and then to visualise ourselves in our happy place. He repeats the mantra, "Spiders are safe," multiple times before guiding us back to full alertness. This is the game changer, he says. Hypnotherapy is a powerful tool. It's how we can make a change in just one afternoon. It's time to visit the spider house to see if the hypnotherapy has worked. We walk through a glasshouse full of bushes festooned with giant webs. In the middle of each is my nemesis, a plump golden orb spider. Miraculously, I feel completely calm. Now for the catch and release trial, whereby I move a British house spider gently onto a piece of card, as if to release it in the garden. Again, not even a flutter. Finally, the moment where I hold a Mexican red-kneed tarantula called Katie. Her huge black and red hairy body spans the entire width of my cupped hands, and she's a similar weight to a small hamster. She's silent and unmoving. I hold her close to my face, smiling broadly as my photo is taken. Australia and my daughter, here I come.
Dave has taken listener Elizabeth Smith back to the church where she was christened 84 years ago. And she and Dave speak to an 85-year-old fundraising volunteer at Claybrook Parish Church.
I'm speaking to you from St Peter's Church, Claybrook Parva. And who am I speaking to now?
I'm Brian Fowler. And I'm a church member here in the church and help wherever I can.
Okay, great. And you've just jumped out of the plane, haven't you?
I have indeed. I've done a number of things in my lifetime, crazy things perhaps. Yes. And yet, 2 weeks ago, that's on the 13th of September, I sat in a tiny little plane, and we climbed up into the skies above the fluffy white clouds above Langer Airfield in Nottingham. I was with four other people who were undertaking the same sort of leap into faith as I was, and we jumped out of the plane, sailed through the clouds without a parachute at this stage, falling some 2 miles in about 2 seconds, with the wind rushing past our hair, and I was smiling all the way. It was absolutely exhilarating. And then at about 5,000 feet above the ground, we then opened the parachute and, as I recall it, danced through the sky. I was in charge of the chute at this stage, and we danced around looking at the beautiful little fields down below and the little white dots in the fields, which are gradually turned into cows, and then we could see the amazing crowds down below waving to us. It was an exhilarating experience. I was backed by a good many people here in the community, and the cause was, because I like doing mad things, but also to raise money for Rainbow's Children's Hospice in Loughborough, where every penny counts. And as a result of the support I got, I was able to hand over some £2,000.
How old are you, by the way?
I'm 85.
Gee whiz.
I'm still fairly...
Awesome.
Fairly fit. The week before that jump, I had run in my green Macmillan cancer support vest in the Great North Run, which is 13 miles from Newcastle to South Shields.
Yeah.
And next Saturday, I will be abseiling down from the top of the 200-foot high tower in Derby, again to raise money for Rainbows. Yeah. So it keeps me out of mischief, and in the process does good work for other people.
Were you diving in tandem?
I was in tandem, yes.
You were underneath, guy was on top.
I was actually, I could say this, very attached to a very pretty young woman.
Well, good.
She was my professional jumper on the day, so that was an added bonus.
Excellent.
So, yes, we slid on our bottoms towards the hatch where you leave the aeroplane, and then just let go, and that was it. And then she handed me the parachute lines when we were, like I say, 5,000 feet above the ground, and I was in charge of the parachute at that stage, and that's when I described dancing through the sky, because we were able to turn and twist, and that made the final descent even longer, as it were. That took about 5 minutes to do that last 5,000 feet, compared with the 2 minutes during which time we'd fallen 2 miles. So.
Gee whiz, so. That's amazing. Well done.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
I enjoyed it. And, last year I did the wing walking. So I'm not quite sure what I'm going to be doing next year.
The wing walking, you're doing that?
I did that last year.
You stood on the wing of a plane.
Stood on the top wing of a plane with two wings. And the on that occasion, the pilot obviously sits down below you.
Yeah.
He can see you. And after the flight, the pilot said to me, I gauge how my passengers, call for them passengers, are reacting. He said, if I see white knuckles, I fly very carefully. But if I can see people dancing around as you were, then we do the whole hog and we do the loop the loops and we do the lot. And that was amazing too.
Gee whiz, well done. Fantastic stuff. Thank you.
That's why we're here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gee whiz. Yeah. Now I know I'm talking to you. What more did you hear this morning?
Yeah.
Look, this is where I was christened. I'm a war baby.
Yes. Like me, I was a war baby. Yes.
Were you christened here?
No. I lived in Hertfordshire at that time. I was a 1-year-old when our house was destroyed by a stray German bomb. Right, so were you a local girl to be christened?
Well, I was born just down the road in Ullathorpe.
Oh, really? Yes.
And I've just found out I've got a cousin.
Ah, right.
A cousin I didn't know I got.
Marvellous. Right?
Yeah, it's the first time. You've been back since you've been, to that font over
amazing.
There.
Well,
84 years.
We only came in by chance to have a look around. Gee whiz. I found a family that I
I knew they existed, but I'd never met.
Never actually met them.
And I thought, gee whiz, was it your Ken's daughter? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, she said. Quite. I said, wow, I am impressed.
So, do you think you can tell us something about the history of the church, please?
Yes, the church was founded here in about the 16th century, 12th century, I mean, 12th century. There was evidence of a previous small church here prior to that, but we have no record of that at all. So effectively it's a medieval church. There's a little bit of medieval glass in one of those windows, the last fragment of medieval glass. 15th century, the height of the roof was raised, the clerestory windows were added. If you look that end, you can see basically where the original roof was.
Yeah.
So that's 15th century. And then, of course, the Puritans hacked down all of the ornamental timber work, so you can see just what remains. There was a road screen.
Yeah.
At that end, there was a gallery.
Yeah.
Children from Alastorp School, which is where. The school is still there, or the building is still there.
The building is still there, yeah.
Children from there would come to church and sit in the gallery up there. On their way to school, it is alleged, they would call at the house across the way, which had a plunge bath.
Crikey.
In order that they may be cleansed before they went to church.
Wow.
So lots of bits of history. And of course, the... As in many old churches, medieval churches, you can see grooves in the stonework. You can see the grooves around that little recess in the wall there, which allegedly are made by soldiers sharpening their arrows or their swords.
Yeah.
And there's more to be found up in the top end.
Well, thanks a lot for speaking to us. It's been really fascinating.
I'm overjoyed. I love being able to talk about the church and the history of it.
Yeah.
Well, they came in to have a look inside the church.
Well, they came, were you?
Because this is where I started from. Many years ago.
Marvellous. So, well, you don't remember a great deal of that day either, do you?
Shucks, I don't.
Oh, thanks a lot. I'm
glad you came.
Thank you very much.
Now, you'll remember that Nigel gave us a small quiz last week. Well, I'm pleased to give you the answers, and I really hope you did better than I did. Now, question one was, what was Garner's former name? What was Garner's former name? And the answer is Gold Coast. And I thought that was in Australia. Perhaps there used to be two of them. Question two, over which continent did the ozone hole form? And the continent in question was Antarctica, down south. Question three was, where is the pituitary gland? And the answer to that is in the brain. I'm far too embarrassed to tell you where I thought it was. Question four, in which country was former Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith born? And the answer to that is Scotland. I got that one right, by the way. And finally, in which country would you find polders? That's P-O-L-D-E-R-S. And what are they? Well, the answer is you find them in the Netherlands, and they're a stretch of land reclaimed from the sea. So there's probably quite a bit of that in Holland. And those answers bring us to the end of this week's edition. So from me and the rest of the team, it's goodbye.